From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We've been taking stock of the first half of 2022 and revisiting some of the most meaningful conversations. We begin with California's community college system, which is the largest in the country. Back in March, I spoke with Daisy Gonzalez, a first-generation college student who didn't learn English until the fourth grade and navigated the state's foster care system. When she was emancipated, the barriers were high, but she overcame each and every one. From her start at community college to eventually a PhD, and now second in command at California Community Colleges. Our childhood, it doesn't define us, but it does shape who we become. And your story really is exemplary of that. So can we start from the beginning?
Sure. Thank you for the question. You know, I think we spend a lot of time, certainly when we have had trauma or tragedy in our journeys, surviving it, probably avoiding it. And so for me, you know, as I joined certainly California's community colleges, I went to community colleges throughout my childhood, and certainly in order just to graduate from high school, for me, it's really important to come back and to be able to share my story and to feel empowered by that story, because my story is not unique. In many ways, it's very similar to that of the foster youth, the low-income students, and the first-generation college students that this system actually serves today.
What are you comfortable sharing about your journey through the foster system here in California?
You know, my childhood gave me a front row seat to observe and experience the fundamental role of state public institutions and in the development of our children and in our society. And one of those key institutions was schools. I grew up in foster care, whether I knew it or not, since the age of two. I went in and out of the system, and finally, when I was 13, I had to make a critical decision to be able to speak up for myself. I grew up around a lot of violence, both physical and verbal, and I live in different placements. And what was important as a part of this journey that I've now realized as an adult is that those experiences with the foster care system certainly influence the solutions that I create today as a leader. I grew up surrounded by lawyers and judges and social workers and teachers, you know, all of the kind human beings that made me who I am. And while not every experience was positive, what it did teach me was the critical role of the institutions and then who we serve and how we need to serve people. We serve people to empower them. We treat them with dignity.
Were you an English language learner during that time? Because if so, that adds a whole other dimension to this.
Absolutely. You know, I grew up in an immigrant household. I did not learn English until I was in the fourth grade. And so I was a dual immersion teacher myself. That was one of my first jobs, based and grounded in that experience. So to your question about how does your childhood influence you, I was an English learner. I ended up becoming a dual immersion teacher right out of college because I wanted to give back, and because third grade was one of those critical years in my life to be able to succeed and to complete an education.
Yeah. Especially during the pandemic, we have learned that schools are just so much more than education. I would imagine as a child and as a teenager navigating the foster system, was it that way for you too? Was it more than just education?
Absolutely. You know, when I was 13, I was told by county staff, and these are just the different individuals that you experience as you're a foster youth, I was told you have three options for your life. You're either going to end up dead, pregnant, or imprisoned by the age of 16. And it makes me really sad to say that the data hasn't really changed in our state. Less than 4% of our students actually earn a four-year baccalaureate degree. This is for foster youth. So in many ways, earning an education saved my life. It was a critical component of the people that surrounded me, what they taught me about serving others, and more importantly, what they taught me about being able to help others, which is really important when you're serving students who have had tragedy and trauma. The big component is really, how do we help them turn pain into courage and strength? Yeah. And one of the biggest ways that you can do that is by showing them how they can help others. So certainly everything from voting to being politically active to volunteering your community. Those are key components of the educational experience in growing up in California.
Yeah, being engaged. And you had people in your life that showed you that there were other alternatives than the three that you laid out. What kind of support or mentors did you have as a child and teenager?
You know, here in California, even today, we have independent living programs, and those are programs that help our foster youth learn everything from how to balance your checkbook to how to be independent and sign a contract to get housing. I'm very proud to say that I had really incredible mentors. You know, when I entered the foster care system and I was 13 that time around, there was an incredible woman named Connie who created a pilot program to pair foster youth with mentors. I still have that mentor who has known me since I was 13. Her name is Doreen. She's actually the dean of a law school, and she's retiring at the end of this month after a 41-year career in law. Because at one point in time when I was 13, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer because of just the critical role that they played in making sure that I was safe.
I would imagine that she taught you something just so fundamental that one person can make a huge difference. I mean, it's something that is simple and can sound cheesy, but it actually is true and it's meaningful.
She absolutely did, whether she knew it or not. You know, I like to remind her that it was the simple things that she did, right? The first time this Latina immigrant student ate sushi, to seeing an art exhibit at the Getty Museum, you know, being exposed to different things. You know, I often like to share with students and my mentees, you can't become what you don't know exist. And that's really important. That was one thing that she taught me, was just the exposure to different experiences. And through that, she taught me that I could be anything.
I'm just curious, during this time or even throughout your life, did you ever have the chance or even the desire to reconnect with your biological family?
You know, I've had different touch points. You know, since I was 2 years old, I entered the foster care system. I was returned back and forth and then finally emancipated at the age of 17. I think as an adult and what I see in many of the foster youth that I mentor, what is important as we become adults is really more around the community that surrounds us. And I'm really lucky to say that I have mentors, I have friends. For me, my friends are family. And then my team here at the Chancellor's office, they are like a mini family, because for me, family is contributing to a broader goal. And that has been really important to be able to thrive and to help others.
Yeah, and you are one of tens of thousands of stories. There are more than 60,000 children currently in the foster system in California, and each story is very personal and unique. When you left foster care, you were emancipated, and for individuals that are either emancipated or they age out, that can be a dramatic, challenging shift. How did you navigate all of that?
You know, I was really lucky to have a chemistry teacher be a part of my journey. She was my freshman year in high school chemistry teacher, Patricia Barker, at the time. And when I emancipated, I had nowhere else to live. And she said, don't worry, you can live with me. There were only about 6 months between emancipation and being able to graduate from high school. And she was really critical for me to not only have a safe place to live, but to have a complete stranger, right? Someone that was a part of my educational journey say, listen, you have 6 months, there will be rules, but I need you to go to college. She was that person for me. And now I'm very happy to say that, you know, as an adult, I had the privilege of working on a bill that expanded rights and services and resources for all foster youth in the state until the age of 26. So part of my journey has been working for the state legislature as an assembly budget consultant. And when I was 26, I ended up working as the first and youngest Latina to serve in the assembly budget committee. And that was one of the budget changes that we made. We made sure that, unlike me, when I lost all services, foster youth in this state would have resources until the age of 26.
That is definitely something to be so proud of. And that teacher went well beyond a classroom and education in a traditional sense. You mentioned you're a product of the community college system that has propelled you to a PhD. You've worked at the state legislature. You're now deputy chancellor at California's community colleges. But starting off, let's go back to community college. I would imagine there were financial barriers, even just a lack of logistical knowledge is how to navigate higher education. And there's also a component of resiliency to this. How did you manage all of that as a young adult?
You know, I had a lot of really incredible angels, everyday people, from Ms. Barker saying, you're going to go to college, you have to figure out what an SAT is at the time, and you have to help others complete their essays too. And so a lot of folks have asked me around, you know, who is this angel, Ms. Barker? And I ended up creating a chemistry club. And during our lunchtime, we would actually apply to college. And we would each review each other's essays. And it was about telling our story. And that piece is still something that I use today in this journey. Certainly something that I use when I was a third grade dual immersion teacher here in Fairfield, you know, helping students understand that their journey is actually a source of courage. And then when I did work for the state legislature, right after literally leaving the classroom, and the reason why I left the classroom was because at the time we had a teacher shortage, and I see not much has changed, but I couldn't even make photocopies. And that it was a really difficult community, right? I was serving low-income students, immigrant students, and empowering them meant that at the time I thought, well, our state laws need to change. They need to change a little. And I wanted to bring their stories to Sacramento. And it's something that I now use in the work that we do, right? I seek to empower students in California's community colleges and center their voices, their experiences, which are different from the ones that I had, into the culture and the fabric of our institutions and the ones that we hope to become. But yes, California's community colleges were part of my journey. I went to 3 different community colleges in LA just to graduate from high school on time. You know, foster youth have a lot of different placements. We miss out on a lot of school because of courts, because of other incidents that happen when you live in a group home as well. And community colleges were there for me then. They were also there for me when I finally did manage to transfer to a 4-year institution. Because you're a foster youth, when you do end up transferring, you have nowhere else to go in the summer. And so you have to figure out what are your summer plans. For me, it was getting 2 or 3 jobs and going to community colleges so that I can finish earlier because I couldn't afford another year. I couldn't afford to pay for another year.
Wow. Now look at you. You're second in command in the country's largest and most diverse system of higher education. There are more than 100 community colleges in the state, but it is a system, an institution that has historically been white and male at the highest levels. Given this journey that you have been laying out and is remarkable, do you see the consequences that has had on higher education by not having people in power in place that is reflective of the community that they serve?
You know, I think it's the most important piece here is grounding our work and who we serve. And this state currently serves 69% of California Community College students are students of color. And being culturally competent, being compassionate, serving people with empathy and dignity does not have to be a lived experience, but it does have to be prioritized when you're designing solutions. I've been very lucky to have mentors like Chancellor Oakley not only asked me to come and serve, but to see as a role model out there. He is the first Latino chancellor that this state has ever seen for California's community colleges, also a product of California's community colleges. And along with that, this year, we are also breaking ground and making history with the first African-American woman as the president of the Board of Governors. So for me, as we think about designing, as I think about your question, it's that ecosystem of what it means to not only understand who we're serving, but to prioritize and have an inclination that it's really about who we're serving. We have 116 community colleges in our system. And this pandemic, you know, nationally and in California, hit our students especially hard. We've seen declining enrollment. We have seen the challenges with poverty in our system, but also seen the resiliency of our students, our faculty, and our staff. Many of our students during this pandemic have been on the front lines. They are nurses and first responders. They are the everyday folks that are delivering your food and your meals. That's California, you know. Those are our students. Those are the Californians that we serve.
We're going to take a quick break and continue my conversation with California Community College's Deputy Chancellor, Daisy Gonzalez. You're listening to a special edition of Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a special best of edition of Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're going to resume my conversation with Deputy Chancellor Daisy Gonzalez of California Community Colleges, sharing her story as a foster youth and goals to increase equity and representation. You touched upon declining enrollment and even transfer rates for many people. Like you and Chancellor Oakley and myself, community college can be like a best-kept secret, but those enrollment and transfer rates did drop during the pandemic. Where are these young adults going instead? What is the long-term harm?
Yeah, that's really important for us. It's something that all of our leaders in our 116 community colleges are wrestling with. At the statewide level, for us, certainly for Chancellor Oakley, for our board, for our team, raises really big concerns about equitable access to success in higher education, as well as the ability to meet our state's workforce needs. Who we serve are the everyday Californians, from career technical education to English as a second language courses to, yes, transfer. And most recently, the state allowed our colleges to offer an increased number of baccalaureate degrees. So we are the best kept secret, and let's make sure that it's not a secret.
Right.
As a part of the journey, I think of who we're serving is further amplifying the work and the knowledge, right? Making sure that folks understand that during this pandemic, the state legislature, the federal government have made really key investments to ensure that we're recovering with equity. Everything from making sure that we have not only education online, but the student supports, things like tutoring and mental health. Those things are also important to a student when they're learning online. On the other hand, there have also been really big investments to make sure that emergency funds go directly to the students' hands so that they can take care of things like rent, transportation, childcare, food. We have seen during this pandemic what it means for our students to try to survive during this pandemic, everything from homelessness to being housing insecure, which is a very large population of who we serve. And then the other big side of that is food. You know, we feel very comfortable talking about food insecurity in K through 12, but in many ways, those are the same students, right? They become our students eventually. And so food insecurity is really big in our system as well.
Yeah. There are food pantries at universities here, including Sacramento State, where we're located, and also stories of students sleeping in their cars, not only at Sac State, but even within the UC system. Given that you have a background in policy at the state legislature before moving to higher education, where have policies fallen short?
You know, I don't like to think about it as falling short, but more of a, where is there always room for improvement? One key component of the opportunity for us to improve is really in the way that we provide direct supports to our students, and that's really financial aid. Financial aid reform in our state has not kept up with who we serve. It is a system that primarily serves working adults, right? Working learners. These are students who are over the age of 24. I know that we could probably all think of different colleagues who have tried to return back to school, but we do have a large percentage of our students who are over the age of 24. We also know that many of our students work one, two, three jobs. That means that they are also working learners. And so our state policies and certainly our federal policies, you heard a little bit about that in President Biden's State of the Union, right? Pell Grant reform. Here at home, the reform and the opportunity is making further changes to our Cal Grant system. Last year, there were some changes that lifted up the age requirements, so the eligibility for our students, 100,000 more students making history qualified for new Cal Grants. But there's more room and more need, more unmet need. We have the lowest tuition across the nation, $46 a unit. But what's important for everyone to understand is if we want community college students to succeed, it's about the supports that you're providing them to afford textbooks, housing, transportation, childcare. Because it's a moral imperative, because it's who we serve. We, of course, know broadband and technology has become a lot more important during this pandemic. And that means that our financial aid structures and policies then need to change. And they need to change to meet the unmet needs that our students are having.
All right. You mentioned the federal role in this. So I want to get to cost because college is expensive. And I understand that it's $46 a unit across community colleges. But you worked multiple jobs to get through. During the State of the Union, President Biden said a national plan to make community college free failed in the social spending bill. Here in California, tuition can be free if students meet certain income requirements. Where do you stand on community college being free for everyone? Many people stop pursuing higher education, master's, PhDs, even a bachelor's, because debt can rival a home purchase.
You know, we serve 70% of all undergraduates in the state of California, and a very large percentage of CSU students, I believe it's 51%, begin their educational journey at a California community college. And it's a little bit lower for UC. I believe 29% of UC students begin their journey at a California community college. So we're a part of that journey for a reason, right? We help students. We are the gateway. We are the front door to higher education to the majority of Californians. Certainly, our board and the Vision for Success calls us to redesign everything with the student in mind. Our position and the work ahead is really designing a student-centered financial aid system. What's really important to note is that while our unit cost, the $46 per unit, is the lowest in the nation, the unmet needs, the sort of the work ahead, is really all the other pieces that I've highlighted: textbooks, housing, transportation, childcare, broadband, technology equipment. At the core of the cost and the transformation is how do we begin to lift and focus our policies on financial need as we are making awards, right? That's truly what it means to have equity in financial aid structures. How do we reduce barriers that are created by age or GPA requirements? How do we cover all quality certificates and associate degrees that are offered by California community colleges? We have a large percentage of our students that are career technical education students, and they currently don't qualify for certain Cal Grants. In terms of the other part of your question, you know, the big work here in California is how do we do it so that we are doing it with equity? We are very lucky to have a California Promise College grant. The majority of our students do qualify for their tuition to be covered. But again, the unmet cost are all of the other pieces that you and I know are really what gets in the way of our students succeeding.
Do you think community college should be free for everyone?
I think in California, we are the model. We are the model for free community college because
so is it good? Is it good as it stands now?
I don't know if it's, I would say it currently does not meet all of the needs that our students have. So while we cover the unit cost, what it would mean to help our students here in California, for us, it's not a conversation about being free. For us, it's about the total cost of our students' success.
Well, given that you were the interim chancellor, actually, at the end of last year, as Eloy Ortiz Oakley, he took a sabbatical to assist the Biden administration. I mean, the time was short. It was about 4 months. But you then became the first woman of color leading the community college system, only the second community college chancellor that was a woman. And during those 4 months, you embarked on a listening tour across the state. What did you learn from students?
Thank you for the question. You know, I was deeply honored to serve our system in a different role. I've been in my current role now for 5 years, and the work really has been about prioritizing the student voice. And I learned three key things from our students. The first one is this immense need for basic needs. And it changes based on the community. I went to Lassen Community College, a very rural community who had also faced a wildfire. I went to LA Valley College, a very different community, right? One of the campuses that I went to as an undergraduate, and certainly when I was in foster care, LA Valley College was a big part of my journey. Those are two very different communities. So the basic needs were critical and yet unique. And then the second big sort of challenge that our students were facing were better access to the educational modalities that were created during this pandemic, right? And so things like broadband, having access to technology, that was a really big need in our students. And the last one that I heard repeatedly across the state was childcare. And all of that comes together in the vision that we have for California's community colleges. What does it mean to center the student voice and the solutions that we create? What would it look like to meet the total cost of success for our students? So again, going past tuition costs, but really thinking about the financial resources that need to be in the hands of our students. So everything from textbooks to housing to childcare.
Before we let you go, Deputy Chancellor, you talk a lot about unmet needs. And when you hear unmet, that means work needs to be done. And there are students that are listening to this that are living through those unmet needs. What is one thing that California can do now to help?
You know, the number one thing that we can do now and that I want to encourage everyone to do is to share their story and encourage a student to enroll. Once a student arrives to our doors, there are so many resources that we can connect them to. So the first step is get through the door. We are here to help. I need you to enroll. I need you to go to icangotocollege.org. That is really important to us.
Deputy Chancellor Gonzalez, thank you so much for not only joining us, but sharing your story.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Vicky.
That was my conversation with Deputy Chancellor Daisy Gonzalez of California Community Colleges. Our conversation first aired in March. You're listening to a special best of edition of Insight on CAP Radio. Andy Mudrick is a significant milestone in California history. The 58-year-old was appointed by Governor Gavin Newsom as Superior Court Judge in Sacramento County. Back in April, I spoke with Judge Mudrick about being the first openly transgender person appointed by a governor to serve on the bench in state history. When I read the headlines, obviously it leads with the first openly transgender judge appointed to the bench in California. That obviously is historic and meaningful, but what does it mean to you?
It has significant meaning to me, both personally and professionally. On a personal level, I was born female and in a male body, and spent the bulk of my life up until about 4 years ago grappling with my gender identity. And so once I decided to transition and come out, I now live as a proud transgender woman and know that there are many struggles that transgender people face, and feel that I have an obligation in my position to be open and model openness. On a professional level, it's critical that the court reflect the community that it serves. For many reasons, including so that folks who appear before the courts have confidence that the court understands their communities. In California, I'm not the first transgender judge. I'm the first openly transgender judge appointed by a governor. So I want to acknowledge my colleague, Victoria Kolakowski, who is the first openly transgender judge in California. Judge Kolakowski, who's a wonderful human and judge, was not appointed by a governor. She ran for election and has been on the bench for 10 years. Before recent administrations, it was really difficult for LGBTQ people to be appointed as judges, and particularly for transgender folks to be appointed. So I'm proud to be the first. And as Kamala Harris has said, I won't be the last.
Judge Kulikowski, who was elected in 2010 in Alameda County in the Bay Area, she tweeted about your appointment that it's a great appointment, that you will be a wonderful judge, and that I'm glad to finally have a trans colleague on the bench in California. You know, it's been about 12 years. How has she inspired you to pursue and eventually obtain this dream and accomplishment?
She and frankly, other LGBTQ plus judges have shown me how important it is for us to have representation on the court. Representation matters, that there is significant support within the judicial community for folks like me and Judge Kulikowski. And, you know, through that support, I've felt that I have a strong colleagues to guide me through this process.
There's a lot that really leads up to these kind of milestones and accomplishments in one's life. How are you reflecting on the journey that got you here?
I always kind of feel like I am where I'm supposed to be. I sat on a presentation a few weeks ago for International Women's Day, and I had the pleasure to be on the panel with a Latina judge who just retired and who I believe was the first Latina judge on her bench. And one of the things that she said really struck me, which is as she was growing up, she didn't really have a plan for her future or her career. And she didn't know kind of what she wanted to be. And she attributes that to the fact that she didn't see other Latinas in positions of power, of authority as judges. And she never thought that was possible. And so she didn't have a plan, and she wound up where she was, which was a very accomplished jurist. And I that really rang true to me. I never saw transgender people in any positions, quite frankly. I also have a significant disability, and I never saw people with significant disabilities in positions of authority. And so throughout my childhood, throughout my career development, I never really had a plan for what I wanted to do. I just did things that were important to me that helped other people. And, you know, I went to law school, got a position doing civil rights work as my first position. And I've pursued advocating for the civil rights of people from all communities, and in particular, the disability community for the past 20 years. And I feel that I'm where I'm supposed to be, and which is, you know, thankfully and gratefully and humbly becoming a judge and showing other people with disabilities, transgender people, people from all communities, particularly marginalized communities, that that we are part of society, we are part of the community, and we are leaders as well.
Mm. Our lived experience, the layers of that, they don't exist in vacuums, right? And that's really manifested for you in a 33-year career in law, as you say, really focusing on advocacy. You suffer from a significant disability. You're also a parent. You're also a descendant of Jewish Holocaust survivors. How has all of that shaped you and guided you in what you are passionate about?
Great question. We talk a lot about intersectionality these days, and it certainly rings true for me. And I think, you know, as you said, there are a lot of layers to my background. Born to Jewish parents, my father is a Holocaust survivor. He was born in Ukraine. His parents were murdered in the Holocaust, came to this country as a refugee. And as part of our culture, we believe the concept of justice being really important. We also believe in a concept known as repairing the world. And so strong obligation, social obligation to community service, to do what's right and to help others. And so that really obviously shaped a big piece of my identity as a person with a significant disability. I have osteogenesis imperfecta, which is also known as brittle bone disorder. So my bones break easily. I've had over 100 fractures throughout my lifetime. My mother, who is unfortunately no longer with us, had osteogenesis imperfecta, as well as did my sister. And so that shaped a part of who I am. And over the years, because I had family members with disabilities, developed a strong sense of pride and obligation to the disability community. And then, as we've talked about, also transgender, I lived my adult life as a gay man and only came out as transgender 4 years ago. And in addition to that, I'm the proud parent of a 22-year-old son who's Black. And with all of that, I have a strong sense of social justice. And that's kind of been the backbone of who I am and what my career choices have been.
We're going to continue my conversation with Judge Andy Mudrick in just a moment. You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to a special best of edition of Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're going to resume my conversation with Sacramento County Superior Court Judge Andy Mudrick, who's the first openly transgender person appointed by a governor to serve on the bench in California history. You've been Chief Deputy Director at the California Department of Rehabilitation since 2020, and prior to that, you served as its Chief Counsel. How has that experience prepared you to become a Superior Court Judge in Sacramento County?
Before joining the Department of Rehabilitation, I spent decades advocating for the civil rights of people, primarily with disabilities. And obviously that has informed my worldview to some extent. I joined, as you said, the Department of Rehabilitation in 2018, and gaining the perspective of a state agency that serves the public really provides me with a perspective that's quite different from the advocacy roles that I played previously. At the Department of Rehabilitation, we serve people with disabilities who are seeking employment or seeking to retain or advance in employment. We also have programs assisting people with independent living. And so from a service provider perspective and working within state government, understanding how those services are provided and the intricacies of that service really gave me a perspective different from what I had come from. As chief counsel, I also served, chief counsel served as kind of in-house counsel and advised the department on a number of things, including personnel matters, corporate contracts matters. So it gave me a broader perspective and also a perspective sometimes from defending the department against risks and liabilities. So it gave me somewhat of a more balanced perspective, I think.
And that obviously has led to you becoming a Superior Court Judge in Sacramento County. I'm just curious, were you expecting that call? Can you take us back to that moment when you first found out about the appointment?
Sure. And I guess I'm going to go back a year. And I've heard the term imposter syndrome, and I feel like I live that term as do I think many women, many people from language, ethnic distinct, racially distinct communities, feeling like kind of like I'm never good enough, or I could never advance or be a judge. I got a call from another judge about a year ago on a Sunday. I was sitting on my front porch, and she encouraged me to apply for an appointment. And I thought that was ridiculous. I would never be appointed as a judge. but I mulled it over and I decided to apply. It's a lengthy process with significant vetting. I think I was vetted by 4 organizations with significant background checks, and then had interviews with several of those vetting organizations as well. And then got an interview a couple weeks ago on a Thursday from the governor's office asking me to interview the next day. And I did. And I thought, wow, that was quick. And then I got a call less than a week later, letting me know that the governor was appointing me. And I was elated, thrilled, humbled, overwhelmed, and meant many, many more adjectives.
Who was the first person you told? What did you do to celebrate?
I told my boss first, my boss, Joe Xavier, who's the director of the Department of Rehabilitation, who's been a colleague, a friend. Like me, Joe's a person with a disability. Joe's blind. We share a passion for the rights of people with disabilities. And Joe's been an incredible supporter of mine and was very proud and happy for me. Just went out for dinner that night with my family to celebrate.
Given that you have devoted your life to advocating for people with disabilities and with a mindset of civil rights, how has the civil rights of people with disabilities improved since you started your career, and what more needs to be done?
I started my career in 1989, and the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed and signed by President Bush in 1990, the following year. And so before that, there was no federal legislation mandating equal opportunities for people with disabilities in the workplace, in public accommodations, in public services, in transportation. And I've seen significant progress over the past 30 years, having practiced in Michigan, then in Arizona, and then in California, and in all states and federally in recognition of the rights of people with disabilities to equal opportunities in those settings. We have the ADA. We have very strong state laws across the country. In 2000, the Supreme Court issued the Olmstead decision, indicating that under the Americans with Disabilities Act, people with disabilities have a right to live in their communities of choice. And so we've seen many cases and the law that supports the rights of people with disabilities. And for the most part, they're really sound. I think the room for growth still is in societal attitudes about people with disabilities. The societal belief that we can live in society, we can work, we are productive. We have value, not despite our disabilities, but because of our disabilities. Because of my disability, I'm creative, I'm adaptive, I'm smart. And so disability, I hope now and in the future, will be seen as an aspect of diversity that makes all of us stronger rather than a burden to overcome.
What do you think are going to be your biggest strengths as a judge? And what aspects of this new role do you think you'll have the most room to grow?
I think my biggest strengths are that I am calm, I am fair, I'm thoughtful, I listen well, I'm humble. And I think those are all strengths that a judge should have. I think I do have significant room to grow in that I've never been a judge before. I've been a lawyer for 33 years. I've been in court, I've been before judges, but I've never been a judge. And judges in California and the Superior Court here, a wide variety of cases from criminal law to landlord-tenant to family law to juvenile justice. And I have a lot to learn, and I know that. And I will humbly do my best to learn what I need to and to preside over cases in a fair and impartial way.
You bring up a really important point. In accepting this appointment, you're stepping away from the role of that long has been a legal advocate to becoming an impartial judge. Was the decision to step away from something so specific and even with a lens of advocacy, was that difficult for you?
Not at all. again, I've never really had a career plan or path. I knew from when I was a younger attorney that I had a sparkle in my eye for being a judge, that I always thought it was something I would enjoy doing, that I would be proud to do if ever given the chance. And I just never really thought that opportunity would arise for me. I love what I do. I love serving the community. I love advocating, particularly for people with disabilities. Judges play an incredible role in the society in ensuring justice and ensuring that all voices are heard and ensuring that the law is applied and applied correctly and fairly. And those are things I care about deeply. And I suppose while I will miss to some degree advocating so specifically for people with disabilities, I will relish the opportunity to sit as a judge, and I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunity.
You've pledged to use your experiences to ensure everyone who appears before you is welcome in the court system. What does that look like to you? Help us visualize how you hope to accomplish this.
Sure. I actually am really proud. I've been working for almost the past year on a court committee. I was invited to sit on a steering committee for the Sacramento County Superior Court on fairness and equity. And we're working on some trainings for court staff, including the judges, on disability sensitivity. And then we will be doing some training on LGBTQ sensitivity. And I think there's some concrete things that we can do when we look at various communities to ensure that they are included fully. And so when we think about the disability community, it's how we refer to disabilities, how we refer to people with disabilities in people first language, in language that they prefer to be referred to as. It's in things like physical accessibility in the courtroom, as simple as ensuring that folks who use wheelchairs can get into the courtroom, can sit, you know, in the jury box, in the witness box, those kinds of things, that there is accessibility from a visual standpoint, from a communication standpoint, all of those types of things. You know, when we think about LGBTQ inclusivity, it's things like respecting people's pronouns and not assuming things about gender identity or sexual orientation. And not just for those two communities, right? It's for all communities and for both sides of cases. So from prosecution, defense, plaintiff, defense, landlord, tenant, all sides of cases, that everyone who appears in court is welcome and included and respected.
This also comes as California's judiciary, it's among the most diverse in the country. Newly released data shows the number of female judges is increasing. It's becoming more racially and ethnically diverse. Your appointment in California made national headlines, but it also comes at a time when transgender rights are being restricted in other states. If you could speak directly to those transgender communities in those states with a different experience, what would you say?
I've been around a long time. I came out as a gay man when I was 19. I have seen incredible strides in this country for the rights of gays and lesbians. Never in my wildest dream did I believe that same-sex couples could be legally married in this country. Never did I believe that my son's father and I could both appear on my son's birth certificate, which, by the way, didn't happen until he was 15, when marriage equality became the law across this country. So I've seen incredible progress. I also witnessed incredible hate against gay and lesbian people and backlash of laws across the country as well. When I first started law school, in 1986, my first semester, the Supreme Court issued a case called Bowers versus Hardwick, which said that states had the authority to criminalize sex between two consenting adults of the same gender. I've seen that Supreme Court case changed by another case, and I've seen societal acceptance of same-sex couples in a way that I never thought I would. I think we are right now for transgender people where we were 30 years ago for gay and lesbian people. And so what I would say to folks experiencing discrimination is that this is just one place in history, and we will improve. And I think the way to improve is for folks like me to be out and open, and for folks to get to know us and realize that we are human, we are people.
Finally, I want to circle back to something that you said at the beginning of our conversation that has been sticking with me. You know, often we kind of look to others, you know, perhaps people who have accomplished what we would like to accomplish or people who are older than us to see what's possible. But what you're accomplishing and a lot of other people is groundbreaking and not being limited by what already exists, by staying open and staying malleable, because it, you know, the sky is the limit, really. So for people that are listening to this, I think I, for myself included, can relate to that. What advice do you have for people, you know, in whatever they want to embark on in their life?
Really important to be true to yourself. And I guess, you know, I guess who am I to give that advice when it took me until I was 54 to come out as transgender? And at the same time, that is one of my big life regrets, is that I hid that part of who I was, which is a significant part of who I am, for 50 years. And so listening to yourself, sitting with yourself, really understanding who you are and what's important to you, to me, is a huge life lesson that I've learned.
That is Sacramento County Superior Court Judge Andy Mudrick, who's the first openly transgender person appointed by a governor to serve on the bench in California history. Our conversation first aired back in April. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.